I would like to tell you about this project we have been working on in our group with Ricardo Attazzi and two of our students, Florent Baume and Lorenzo Vitale. In this project, what we were doing, we were trying to develop tools for characterizing RG flows. Okay? And the tool I would like to focus on is the local Kalman-Zimanski equation. Now, we all know the Kalman-Zimanski equation. What does it say? It says that if you have a global scale transformation symmetry, it might be explicitly broken by quantum effects. But the breaking of this symmetry can be compensated by modifications of the parameters. Okay? And the implication is that scale transformation can be translated into a flow in parameter space. This is something that we all know. I would like to tell you about some historical description of some other tools that have been developed along the during the recent decades. So we'll go back to 1980 to a paper by Brown and Collins, where what they did, instead of considering global scale transformation, they considered local scale transformations, which are of course encoded in the operator T, the trace of the energy momentum tensor. What they did, they put the theory in a crude background and they computed T in terms of the composite operators, in the bare composite operators, in dimensional regularization. And then what they did was impose a consistency condition that T is finite because T is protected by the world identities of diff invariance. T is a finite operator, but T can be written in terms of other bare composite operators, and this imposes some non-trivial constraints on the theory. They found non-trivial relations between the counterterms of the theory. Okay? So this was Brown and Collins in 1980. I will skip 10 years ahead to work by Jack and Osborne, who did practically something very similar, but this, again, they considered local scale transformation, which are encoded in T, and they put the theory in a curved background, but they also promoted all the couplings to be x-dependent sources. Okay? And then they computed T in terms of the bare composite operators again, and the gravitational terms, but also derivatives of the sources, scalars like d lambda to the fourth. And again, they imposed the same consistency condition, that T is finite. What they found were very interesting results. Very interesting relation between the coefficients of these anomalies, as we will explain. And one of them can be written in the following form. We have a function of the coupling, A twiddle, whose mu dependence is given by this form. Now notice that if this chi ij, which you'll see later, is positive definite, what you have is a proof for the irreversibility of the RD flow. So this consistency condition, that finiteness of T, is a very powerful constraint on a theory. Okay, questions so far?
So what is beta?
Beta is a beta function.
And chi?
Yeah, I will define all these quantities later, but the important thing is that if this is a positive definite matrix, then the change in this A of this function is monotonous. Okay? So I'll define these quantities later. The next step was a year later done by Osborne, where he took a totally different approach, but got the same result. What he did was the following. He considered, again, local scale transformations in the presence of background sources, but now, instead of talking about the finiteness of T, he defined some kind of Kalman-Zimanski symmetry, that local scale transformation can be compensated by local transformations of the background sources. Okay? So he defines some kind of, it's a kind of generalization of the Weyl symmetry. And this time his consistency condition was that this symmetry is abelian. Now it turns out that exactly the same equation that Jack and Osborne got from the finiteness of T, you can get from imposing that this symmetry is abelian. Okay? What is the advantage of this approach? Is that in the previous case of Jack and Osborne, they computed things for specific models and in dimensional regularization. This formalism developed by Osborne in 91 is totally independent of the regularization scheme, and it's independent of the details of the model. So it's a very powerful tool, which I would like to describe in more details. Okay? So let us discuss a little bit about the tool, the ingredients that appear in this local Kalman-Zimanski equation. So first of all, the local scale transformation are implemented using a background metric. This thing that we're rescaling is a metric. Okay? It's not dynamical, it's just a background field. The local scale transformations of the parameters is implemented, as I said, by promoting the parameters to x-dependent fields. And their transformation is controlled by the beta functions. Okay? So I can define a symmetry generator. Okay? I change the background metric, and I change the background sources. Okay? So this is how I would define the local Kanzi magic symmetry. Now, in fact, these background fields, these lambdas that I defined, are a very useful concept for two more reasons. One of them is that if you have such kind of background sources, they can act as sources for renormalized operators. Okay? If you take your partition function and you define W as a renormalized generating functional for correlation function of composite operators, you see that if you take W and take derivative with respect to lambda, you get the operator O, for example. Or you take the derivative with respect to the metric, you get T mu nu. If W is finite, then you're guaranteed that this is a finite operator. Okay? If you take more derivatives, you get finite correlation functions. So this is a very useful concept. Okay? Moreover, they can act as spurions. Okay? If some interaction breaks a global symmetry explicitly, you can formally restore the symmetry by assigning these background sources by some kind of transformation properties. Okay? So these are a very useful concept, these background fields. Another useful concept I would like to mention is a dilaton, a background dilaton. Now, when I will discuss a dilaton, I'm just considering a redundant notation. Okay? I'm taking the metric and I'm rewriting it like this. What's the motivation? The motivation is that now if I take derivative with respect to tau, you see I can rewrite it like this, I get the trace of the energy momentum tensor. So derivative with respect to tau will give me correlation functions of t. Okay? So whenever I say an effective action for the dilaton, in fact what I mean is a bookkeeping device for endpoint functions of t. It's not a dynamical field. You don't have to consider any asymptotic states, anything. Just a background field which acts as a source for t. Yes?
Just a question about the x dependence
of
the lambda. Is it just a trick, is it recommended, or is it in fact more phenomenal? That is, at some point, you will have to have
no,
dependence.
It's a trick.
To have consistency.
No, at the moment, it's going to be, it's just a trick.
Okay.
It allows you to describe things in the theory, like contact, we'll see that it allows you to describe things like contact terms in correlation functions in an easy way. But it's just a formal trick. There is no physical thing. No, not that I can see at the moment. But maybe if you can ask this question later. Okay. So let's go back. Now that we have the ingredients, let's write down the local Kanzi-Magic equation. So we define this symmetry where we have local scale transformations compensated by changes of the parameters. And the equation means that the W, our generating functional, is invariant under the symmetry up to anomalies. Okay? So this is the local Kanzi-Magic equation. Now, this anomaly A would be the most general scalar that you can write using the sources and their derivatives. Okay? And we'll see later what does that mean. One useful thing is to see that since W is a generating functional of composite operators, the same equation, you see, can be written in an operator form. Derivative with respect to tau gives you t. Derivative with respect to lambda gives you the operator oi.
What is sigma?
Sigma would be some parameter. This is a transformation parameter. Some general arbitrary transformation parameter that you can choose. In order to get this expression, you just say sigma equals delta Dirac delta. Okay? But, okay. So now we mentioned the concept of consistency conditions. So the consistency condition on this equation is that this symmetry is abelian. So from this equation, I will get constraints on the coefficients of the generator. I can also get constraints on the anomaly. Notice that if I act on W with this commutator, I get this what is known as the Wessel-Minow consistency condition. So
can you say that a little more clearly?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's a one-dimensional parameter, why should it not be a
dimensional? Yeah.
What is
okay. So we will see later that this this operator will depend on derivatives of the couplings, and we will see that if you act twice with this operator on itself, then you get stuff which are non-zero. For example, you get something like go like sigma 1 d mu sigma 2. And since sigma 1 and sigma 2 are two different arbitrary functions, this doesn't necessarily vanish. So the coefficients of sigma 1 d mu sigma 2 must vanish. This would be a constraint on the generator.
And is it simple to understand why that's a problem?
Sorry?
Is it simple to understand why that consistency condition?
Okay. Well, it's true. So in fact, you can derive this equation, let's say in dimensional regularization, where you see that when you do dimensional regularization, then you have a vial symmetry in the theory in which you give the bare parameters some simple vial weights. These simple vial weights for the bare parameters are translated into the very complicated transformation of the renormalized parameters. But when you consider the bare action, all you have is just a simple vial symmetry. And this symmetry is abelian. Okay, so that's one way of seeing that this has to be abelian. I hope this answered your question. If not, we can discuss it later. Okay, so these equations, these Wes-Domino conditions, in fact lead to 10 differential equations relating between many parameters in the theory. And one of them is the one that I mentioned earlier. But the question, this is well known. This is something from the 90s. One of the questions I would like to ask, what about all the other equations? What about all the other 9 differential equations that we have? So one of the things that we did in our work is to clarify this issue by reformulating the anomaly, okay, and showing that most of the other equations indeed do not constrain the RG flow. But only one of them, which is related to an F squared, where F is a quantity I will define later, only for this one we have a non-trivial consistency condition. So what we did was to clarify this issue. One of the things we did was to clarify the structure of the anomaly and the constraints. Okay. Now, I will jump 20 years ahead to 2011 to another tool for characterizing RG flow. And this time, instead of studying a single insertion of T, we're considering correlators of T, okay, or what is known in the jargon as dilaton scattering amplitudes. This was used by Komagodzki and Schwimmer in 2011. And by writing these correlation functions, and then using analyticity and unitarity to write analyticity to write dispersion relations, and then use unitarity to get some positivity constraint, they got some interesting results on the properties of RG flows. They were able to compare two limits of the flow, to a CFT in the UV and a CFT in the IR, across non-perturbative regimes, and show some quantities which are larger in the UV than in the IR. So this was a very non-trivial result, which is known as the A theorem. And I'm quite sure you all heard of it, and it implies that the flow from one UV fixed point to another IR, one CFT to another CFT is one directional. So it's a very powerful result. The same amplitude was used by Luti, Polchinski, and Ratazzi to constrain the asymptotic limits of perturbative RG flows. What they show that if you consider a perturbative RG flow, that the beta functions should asymptotically vanish. Okay, so this is also another non-trivial result used by these dispersion relations for correlators of T. Now, there are several issues that are involved in this discussion, but I would like to focus on two of them. Now, the Komagodzki and Schwimmer used the dilaton effective action as a fixed point, which is it's well known. It's constrained. Roughly speaking, it's constrained by the structure of the vial anomaly. I will not get into these details, but sometimes, but there is an issue which is I would like to mention for people who are familiar with this theorem, that when you're comparing two CFTs, it could be that one of them might not be a real CFT. It might be unimproved. T might be not vanishing, it might be proportional to box of O, where O is a mentioned two operator. How does this affect the scattering amplitude? This point will be clearer later. I promise I will explain it in more details later. Another issue is that Luty, Porchinsky, and Rataxi use their effective action of criticality. They could not use these constraints of the Weyl anomaly to write the Dirac-Tone effective action. And they claim that the imaginary part of the Dirac-Tone scattering amplitude is controlled by the beta function. Is it? So one of the questions that we ask is whether this is obvious. Okay. So in what I will present, I will use the local Kanzi-Magic equation to answer these questions. What I will do, I will compute the Dirac-Tone scattering amplitude, the contribution to the Dirac-Tone scattering amplitude of criticality, or in the cases of unimproved theories. Okay? And this will clarify these points and show that they are indeed robust. These proofs are indeed robust. So how will I do it? How will I use the local Kanzi-Magic equation to compute the Dirac-Tone effective action? So as we shown earlier, the local Kanzi-Magic equation can be written in an operator form. I will show that you can use it to act several times with this insertion of T and and then translate them into composite operator correlators multiplied by beta functions plus anomaly related contact terms, which will be generalization of this thing. So the new result that I will present is a systematic approach for computing correlators of T of criticality. Okay? And this would also require the result that I mentioned earlier about the reformulation of the anomaly. So the main points of the talk will be the following. I would like you to remember, after the end of the talk, I would like you to remember the following points. The local Kanzi-Magic equation can be used to characterize RG flows in two ways. First, by studying its consistency conditions, and two, as a tool for computing correlators of T. And you'll see that there are a lot of details involved in the process. I'll tell you about the improvement in the formulation of the anomaly that we found, and which isolates only the interesting constraints on the theory. I will show how to use this new formulation of the equation to give expression for the Dirac-Tone effective action of criticality. Okay? And we will also show that we clean some issues related to the A theorem and LPR's argument. So, as this was the introduction, and then now I'll start with the local Kanzi-Magic equation. I'll then move on to the anomaly and finish with endpoint functions of T. Questions so far? So, what is the setup that we're considering? We're considering a 4D fixed point. Okay? We put the theory in a curve background metric. We assign dimensionless sources to all the marginal operators in the theory. And we define a renormalized generating functional W, as we said. If you take derivative of W with respect to lambda, you get the composite operator correlators. And in the end, we'll always consider a background where the metric is flat, the couplings are constant, and our couplings are very close to their value at the fixed point. This is a setup. And the local Kanzi-Magic equation, as we said, will take this form. Any scale transformation is compensated by changes of the parameters up to an anomaly. But in general, dimension 4 operators, but there could be operators of various dimensions, O alpha with dimension D alpha. So we could assign a source for each of these operators, and its dimension would be 4 minus D alpha. And then this would generalize our equation to something like this, where this is, again, the background field, this is an anomalous dimension matrix. So this is something we could do, but in the background which we are considering, we're just perturbing by marginal deformations, this will not affect our computation. Okay, and in fact, you could always do it, but it's not a very interesting thing. Except, and there's that's also default. Yeah. Sure. But there is an exception to what I just said. And this is the case of dimension 2 operators and dimension 3 currents. Because when I consider the basis of renormalized dimension 4 scalar operators, I have to take into account, in addition to these guys, these dimension 4 scalars, I have to take into account derivatives of currents and box of dimension 2 operators. So we have to, therefore, to add more background fields let's call them A and M, where this is like a background gauge field, and this is a dimension 2 source, such that if I take the derivative of W with respect to M, I get the dimension 2 operator, and derivative with respect to A, I get the current. Okay? So if I have these background gauge fields, I can promote all of my derivatives to covariant derivatives, again, where these are the background gauge fields. So we'll do the same thing. We will evaluate everything in a flat metric where the couplings are constant and M and A are vanishing. Okay, so this is the setup. Now we are ready to write the most general symmetry allowed by dimensional analysis. And it takes the following form. Again, we have a scale transformation compensated by transformation of the parameters. You see that here we have derivative with respect to A, here we have derivative with respect to M, and I write the most general thing I can allowed by dimensional analysis. Because this is dimension 2, here I have the scalar curvature or box of lambda, etc. And all these things are just parameters, functions of the lambdas. Okay? And the equation will be that if I act with this operator on W, I get an anomaly. This is my local current symmetric equation. So if we want to get some feeling about the meaning of the parameters, I can write it in an operator form. Again, as I said earlier, you take sigma to be just delta function, and then since you act on W, you get the renormalized operator. So for example, T would be written as beta times O minus d mu j mu minus box of O. And these S, A, and T are parameters which appear here and here. Or for example, if I would like to consider the running of renormalized operators, where D is some kind of global scale transformation operator. So you see that the anomalous dimension for such an operator would involve both derivatives of beta function, but also some new parameters, rho and D, which appear here and here. So you can go and find a physical interpretation for each one of the parameters here. One comment I would like to make notice that the currents are renormalized because I'm allowing for the coupling to be x dependent, and they can break the symmetry explicitly. Okay, so if the symmetries were conserved, then the currents would not be renormalized; they would be protected by word identities, and they would not contribute to any of these discussions. But here we are assuming that they're explicitly broken by the sources. So what I would like to discuss for the next few slides are subjects like renormalization scheme, improvement schemes, some ambiguities that exist inherently in this equation. Then I will mention the consistency conditions and some comment about transformation properties of functions. Yes?
Why did you stop adding vector sources? Why do you only have that scalar and vector sources?
And why not So as I said, you could do it. Simply, I just know that it's not going to be very interesting. Okay? But because it's not going to affect the basis of the dimension 4 operator. Okay, so when I say renormalization scheme, another way of presenting it is just to say that I wrote W in terms of background sources. I could choose a different basis for these sources. I can replace A with A prime, which is shifted by d mu lambda. This is allowed by symmetry and dimensional analysis. Or I can take M and replace it by M plus scalar curvature. This is just a change of basis. Physically, the meaning would be that if I now take derivative with respect to lambda, I would get a different operator. So this is like a change of basis of renormalized operator. This is a change of scheme. Okay. Notice that by a specific change of scheme, I can set some of the parameters to zero. So a change of basis of the sources is a change of renormalization scheme for the composite operators. Another scheme that I have is the subject of improvement. Any theory is defined in a flat background, is defined up to improvement of the energy momentum tensor. By that I mean adding some transverse operator, derivatives of a dimension 2 operator. As far as T, the tracing concerned, this is like adding to T box of O. Now, in a curved background, this is not something I can choose any way I want. It is determined by the coupling of O to the scalar curvature R. Okay. But I know already that in the framework of local Calendar Gizemanchik equation, the relation between T and box of O is determined by this coefficient here in the expression for T. There is a coefficient TA. So TA describes the choice of improvement scheme in my theory. So let's say if I have a fixed point, which is unimproved, that T is non-vanishing, it's vanishing up to box of O, that would mean that zero, that TA would be non-zero. Okay, so TA measures how much my theory is improved or not. Questions? Okay, so we discussed renormalization scheme and improvement scheme. Now let's another kind of ambiguity in this equation. So for, consider a global symmetry. We have this kind of word identity, okay? And now all I'm doing, because it is zero, I add it to the other equation, to the current Zeeman-Chomsky equation. It doesn't change the equation. If I change, if I choose a specific transformation parameter, sigma times some function w, omega, this can be absorbed into a change of the beta functions, or the rho's, or the s. Okay, so there is an ambiguity in the definition of these beta functions. In fact, I can set, by a specific choice, I can set SA to zero. Okay, let me emphasize this point. So the beta functions are ambiguous. This is not something which is, this is something which is inherent in the renormalization procedure. Okay, any beta function is defined just up to a change like this. But you can define functions which are invariant. For example, if define this B to be beta I minus S T lambda, then the transformation of beta and S would cancel each other and you get something which is non-ambiguous, which is a more physical definition for what is a beta function, okay?
So, can you just remind
yeah.
Beta is the beta function of all the normal operators.
Yes. Yes.
Rho I of A is the beta function of
It's a kind of, rho I specifically is a part of their anomalous dimension matrix that defines how the dimension 4 operator mixes with d mu j mu.
And S?
And S defines how the mixing between T, exactly, it appears here, and d mu j mu. So if you set S to 0, it's like you're saying that you're choosing a basis where T is independent of d mu j mu. Okay? Any other questions? So, indeed, if I choose this basis where T is independent of d mu j mu, I get this equation. Now, recall that the condition for a conformal invariance is T equals zero. And that means that if you want to have a conformal theory, you have to make sure that B is zero. Not necessarily the beta function, but you have to make sure that B is zero. So, there are CFTs with non-zero beta functions. Okay? They were found by Fotan, Greenstein, and Stergio in 2012. But the important point is that due to this ambiguity, the important quantity is B. Okay?
Can you also add the decompression?
Excuse me?
Do you also add the decompression?
To this, as a, you mean as a global symmetry or? Let me think. So when you say that, you mean. Okay, so the symmetries I'm considering here are just the Val transformation, just the rescaling of the metric, and the global flavor transformation. And you would like to add also...
You
want to have a dynamical metric or something like that? No. Yes, I didn't consider it.
It's very good for string theory, so... I think okay. Especially you were doing that for two-dimensional nonlinear symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
In the background, then the global symmetry contains the homomorphism and the ambiguity there.
Okay, I would be happy to discuss it in more details later.
Cycling,
okay.
A nose bond.
Okay, I would be happy to hear about it more. So we discussed some kind of renormalization schemes and ambiguities. Let's discuss the consistency condition of this operator, okay? So this, we have this equation, and as we said, we want terms like sigma, d mu sigma prime, to vanish from this commutator. And this leads to three equations relating between the parameters, and one can eliminate eta and d. This is not very interesting, but this equation is more important. Okay, b dot p is zero. Notice that these are the equations that the functions that we defined here. Why is this an important equation?
So what is the meaning of p? B is the sort of improved form. Yeah. What is p?
P is the improved version of rho. Okay, but let me just give you immediately a simple physical interpretation. So let's assume that we work in this basis where T equals B of B times O, where T is orthogonal to D mu J mu. Okay. Now, the implication of this consistency condition is that, let's say you now do a global rescaling, this orthogonality is preserved along the RG flow, because if, as we said earlier, the renormalization of OI is determined by P, okay, times D mu J mu, it's one of the coefficients appearing here. You see that if I consider the renormalization of T, which is B times O, I'll get B dot P here. But this would vanish. So we see that if T was independent of D mu J mu earlier, it will remain independent of D mu J mu. Okay? And the conclusion is that it is not necessary to know anything about correlators of J mu in order to compute correlators of T. Okay? Because if you once set T to be orthogonal to d mu j mu, it will remain like that throughout the RG flow. So this is a very useful result, which allows us to simplify computations of correlators of T. Okay? So this is a physical implication of this consistency condition. Now we'll see later that the same thing can be said about the anomalies. You don't need to know anything about the anomalies related to the external gauge fields. So, but this will be clarified in more details later.
Still the case that with these consistency conditions, T remains finite?
T remains finite, yeah. That's okay. So anything we have here, we are only dealing with finite renormalized operators. Why? Because everything is written in terms of derivatives of W, which is by itself a finite renormalized generating functional. Okay? So everything here that we will write are just finite correlators. One point before, which is relevant to the discussion of the structure of the symmetry, is what happens when you take some arbitrary function and you act on it with this operator. So let's say that you have this function is depends on derivatives of the lambdas. What you'll find, and let's forget for a moment about this Lie derivative, which is an interesting thing, but I'd rather skip it, is that you have, in variation of this function, you have d mu of sigma. Or the variation of box lambda, you have box of sigma. So these guys do not transform covariantly. Okay? But I can define combinations of derivatives of the lambdas and box of lambda and r, which do transform without derivatives of sigma, which transform covariantly. We denote them by pi and m. They are given by this combination of d mu lambda squared, box lambda and r, and the dimension 2 source. And the important thing is that they transform without derivatives of sigma. This is, at the moment, it doesn't sound so interesting, but in a few slides, you'll see how important these functions are. Okay. So let us summarize this discussion of the symmetry itself. By a choice of a basis of renormalized operators, adding word identities and imposing consistency conditions, the generator of the local Calendzi matrix equation can be written in a more compact form. Okay, the consistency conditions make sure that correlators of T are independent of the renormalized currents. And also, we define dimension 2 covariant functions of the sources pi and n. Okay? So this is an intermediate summary. Any questions?
Can you go back and tell us about the Lie derivative?
Okay, sure. Yeah, okay. So this is kind of, if you have some kind of a function in with some lower index, some kind of form in your parameter space, then you can define how this function changes along the RG flow. Okay, so it's given like, it has a form of a Lie derivative because it if you remove this guy from here, then this looks exactly like a Lie derivative. But it's not exactly the same thing.
because you have these terms as well. It satisfies properties like this, which are very useful when you're generalizing, when you're digging into the details of the computation. But this is just a useful notation. It describes how a function changes as along the RGflow. So let's move on to the anomaly. Before we go and discuss the local Kanzi magic anomaly, let's go back and discuss the vile anomaly, the anomaly at the fixed point. We're just in the symmetry where you just modify, you just vary the background metric. So this is the form of the anomaly. This is the most general dimension for scalar that you can, which is diff invariant. You have the Euler density, you have the curvature scalar squared, you have the vile tensor squared, and you have box of R. Each one of these anomalies have some specific properties. For example, box of R is an anomaly which can be set to zero by adding local terms to our effective action. So it's not a genuine anomaly. So let's forget about it for the moment. There is a paper, which I forgot to add its reference here, by Desser and Schwimmer, where they classify the remaining types of anomalies. There is a type A anomaly, which is the Euler density anomaly, which is characterized by the fact that it vanishes when integrated over space-time. This is true in non-compact spaces because E4 is a total derivative. Okay? Type B is an anomaly which does not vanish when integrated over space-time. So W squared, the vile tensor squared, is such an anomaly. R squared anomaly is in fact not allowed at all because it does not satisfy the Weiss-Domino condition. Then remember this the consistency condition that I wrote earlier? This consistency condition means that B must vanish. Okay? So these are four kinds of terms that you can find. Stuff that are not anomalies, type A, type B, and stuff which are not allowed by the Weiss-Domino condition. Now, in our case, the classification into type A and type B was not as useful because even though E4 is a total derivative, A times E4 is no longer a total derivative because A is a function of X. So what we do for our own understanding, we generalize this classification to the case of when you have background sources. So now what we call type B would mean that an anomaly which is manifestly consistent. It satisfies, its variation contains no derivatives of sigma. So the commutator would always vanish. Type A will be an anomaly which is not consistent in the presence of background sources unless you impose some non-trivial relations between the different anomalies. So you see that only type A can be interesting. Only type A implies some non-trivial constraints on your theory. Okay, because they can only be consistent if you impose these relations between the other anomalies. So we're now ready to look at the local Kanzi magic anomaly, which is this beast here. Now, when we saw it, so this is the most general thing that you can write, which is allowed by diff invariance, scaling analysis, and dimensional analysis, and in the symmetries of theory, but it is a bit, it looks a bit meaningless, right? It's not clear what is the meaning. So one of the things that we did was to attempt and clarify the structure of this anomaly. So in fact, these 25 anomaly coefficients are functions of lambda, and they are constrained by 10 differential equations, which are derived from this consistency condition. For example, let's say you have these terms in the anomaly. You have M times R with a coefficient QA. And similarly, with these two other three coefficients. The commutator contains something like this multiplied by this combination of the coefficients. So in order for this anomaly to be consistent, these guys must vanish. Okay? And there are around 10 such equations. One of them is very interesting. Okay, this one, which involves the E4 anomalies and the anomalies of the Einstein tensor, if you look at the impose the vanishing of this term in the commutator, you get something that looks like this. Okay, Again, these three parameters, A, chi I, j of g, and w of I, they're related by this differential equation. If you multiply by b, what you find is that b times di of a, twiddle, where a twiddle is defined here, has this property, okay? Has this form. Now again, if chi I, j of g is positive definite, we have a function which changes monotonously along the RG flow. This is a function which is coming from the anomaly, just a function of the lambda. It has no explicit dependence on mu. So this is a powerful constraint on the theory. Okay, so this is a celebrated equation from Jack and Osborne paper. But what about all the other equations? Do they have interesting implications? So it turns out that you can simplify the structure of the anomaly. So the first step was to remove everything which is everything that you can remove by a choice of scheme, you isolate. You put it to the side, and you can set it to zero. There are seven such terms that can be set to zero. The interesting thing is that once you do that, most of the differential equations are simply replaced by algebraic constraints. So you can go back, go and take this equation, and now you can simply plug this expression instead of QA. By doing that, you can eliminate 8 more terms in the anomaly. And after all the dust settles, you can write what we call the generalized vial symmetry. It has the same form. We divide it according to the same form of the vial anomaly. We have a W squared anomaly, E4 anomaly, generalized, of course. And we find that there is also a generalized R squared anomaly, which I will show you in a second. And in the end, you have only 2 consistency conditions left. So let's look at the different generalized anomalies. Okay, so the vial squared anomaly remains the same. The only difference is that C becomes a function of the couplings. This anomaly is manifestly consistent because W squared is invariant under our symmetry. So this thing transforms with without derivatives. So it's a type B anomaly. It's not interesting, at least from our analysis. The interesting thing is that many of the terms in the anomaly can be simply wrapped up into this expression. Now, these are the mentioned 2 covariant functions that we defined earlier, okay? We have this m and pi. So, in fact, the meaning of most of the consistency condition is that this anomaly is the most general thing that you can write in terms of the covariant functions pi and m. And this is manifestly consistent. Okay, so it's what we call a type B anomaly. Now, the reason I'm calling it an R squared anomaly is because when you set all the background fields to zero, all you are left with is something that looks like this. Okay? Now, an interesting point is that remember that T is non-vanishing if you're considering a fixed point. T is vanishing only if you improved the theory. Okay? If the theory is not improved, then you'll find here something. You'll find here an R squared anomaly. It's a new type of anomaly, which is present in unimproved fixed points. And this is relevant for the A theorem. And in fact, what I will show in a few slides, that the A theorem is smart enough to be blind to this effect. Okay. If any of you are familiar with Buchan's conjecture, it is relevant to that as well. Okay. In addition, we still have something which is not as clean, which is a generalized E4 anomaly. This is depends on the 3 coefficients, A, W, I, and chi I, j, that we defined here, that we are already familiar with, and they're related by this equation. And indeed, this is a genuine constraint on the QFT. Okay, so this is still not very clean, but it has a well-defined structure. For example, so if this lambda is in fact box lambda plus, you know what? It is not my purpose to get into the details of this structure, but what I do want to show is the last anomaly, which is the F squared anomaly. F mu nu would be simply the field strength associated with the background gauge field. So we still have this kind of an anomaly for current Riemannian equation. Notice that they are very similar in their structure. Okay. For example, look at this guy over here. the same thing you have over here, okay? And again, you have three parameters related by some kind of one consistency condition. In fact, these are two, but this one can, the lead derivative of this guy can be written in terms of the other two. So you, we're not considering it as a genuine constraint. So this equation is an equation that is the only one except the famous one here. The only problem is that we don't have a physical interpretation for this equation. So one of the things that remains as a puzzle from our analysis, what's so special about this equation? What is the physical meaning of this equation? Can we use it in some sense to constrain other aspects of the RG flow? I would like to use it somewhere into constraint in a way to constrain the symmetries or the accidental symmetries in the flow. But at the moment, we don't know how to extract interesting information from this equation. Okay, so let us summarize. So we found that most of the consistency conditions are eliminated when using covariant functions to write the anomaly. One of the remaining equations is the irreversibility of the RG flow, related to the irreversibility of the RG flow, and the other, we don't know exactly what does it mean at the moment. Another comment, maybe some of you saw that recently, Nakayama wrote the local Kanzi magic equation in three dimensions, and some of the anomalies that he found can also be simplified by using analogs of pi and m. Now, the last point is that this new form of the anomaly is a good starting point for computing the dilaton effective action. And this leads us to the next part of the talk. But if any questions so far?
Can you just comment on the previous slide, the new equation you have?
Yes.
And I don't know, is it
simplified? Okay, for example, so P, if you have a related to the renormalization of a conserved current. So if for example, you have a current which is conserved, then this term would vanish. And kappa AB, this coefficient of F squared, would decouple from this equation. This is one limit that you can look at this equation. At the moment, we don't know exactly what to do with it in order to, because for example, if you multiply by B as you did in the, as you do in the other equation, then you get something which is trivial. So it's not obvious how to use it at the moment, but it's, for us, it's a very interesting question.
So what are the correspondences of some simple theories?
Okay, what do the coefficients correspond to? For example, kappa AB would be the beta function for a gauge coupling. Okay, this zeta AIJ would be the parameter which controls the renormalization of a correlator of two currents in the dimension four operator. This would be the physical significance. I don't know. I don't have any better way of describing it. So any other questions? Okay, so let's discuss how to use this to compute endpoint functions of T. So as we said, correlators of T are given by derivative with respect to tau. So I can package this up into, by using a Taylor expansion, I can package this into a Dilaton effective action written in this form. Okay, just as a Taylor expansion of this effective action. Now, since this delta tau of W is just derivative with respect to tau, we can rewrite it in terms of the Kanzi magic operator plus this delta tau of beta, where beta is just the part where only the parameters transform. Okay? Why is this useful? Let's, for example, take a look at a single insertion of T. It can be written in terms of delta tau beta plus an anomaly. This is obvious. If we want to consider two-point functions, so first step, you just take the Kanzi magic equation in here, replace it with beta plus an anomaly. Okay, you then commute these two terms, you get something like this, and you act again with the Kanzi magic equation. What you get is just two types of terms. Terms which are ultra-local related to the anomaly, and terms which involve correlation functions of composite operators. Remember that delta tau beta, here's the expression, it involves derivative with respect to lambda. So you get a correlator of OI, OJ here. So these D of W give me a non-local contribution, and these C's will give me an ultra-local term in the effective action. Roughly speaking, this can be generalized in this way to any endpoint function using this recursive formula that we found. Okay, so now you have a prescription of how to compute any correlators of T using the data from the local Kalinowski equation. And you always find two types of terms. Terms which are non-local, which correspond to the coupling between a dilaton and composite operators, and ultra-local terms related to the anomaly in which the dilatons couple to each other. Okay, so let us start just from the discussion of the ultra-local terms related to the anomaly using these different anomalies that we have defined. Okay. So we have the generalized W squared anomaly, and this doesn't contribute to the dilaton effective action because it vanishes in a flat background, so we can forget about it. There's also the generalized F squared anomaly, the one involving the background gauge field. We know that if we use the gauge, remember that SA is zero, this will not matter to the dilaton because, for example, if I act on A, on the gauge field with this operator, I would get P times d mu lambda. Now, if I take a constant a background where the lambdas are constant, this would not contribute. However, if I act again with this operator, I can eliminate lambda from here, but I will get B dot P. Okay, but this would vanish thanks to the consistency condition. So we see that by choosing this gauge, we can forget about both the currents and the external gauge fields. Now, let's look at the generalized R squared anomaly. It turns out that once you write it in the form that we have suggested, the effective action of criticality is given by this form, okay? This simple form. The generalized box R anomaly, which I didn't mention, which is, in fact, all the terms which are can be eliminated by a choice of scheme, their contribution has a very similar form. Why is it important? Because both of these types of anomalies vanish when you impose the on-shell condition, the condition that box tau minus d tau squared is zero. Okay? What is another way of writing this on-shell condition is to define a different dilaton. Okay? If we define tau, this is our dilaton, we can define a different background field, phi, defined by this relation. And if we impose box phi equals zero, it's equivalent to imposing that this guy is zero. Okay? So the point I was trying to mention and to explain is that if you choose a dilaton which satisfies this kinematics, it will be blind to the generalized R squared anomaly and the box R anomaly. So if you want to compute your effective action, the dilaton scattering amplitude, it doesn't matter if you have scheme-dependent anomalies, and it doesn't matter if your theory is not improved. Okay, the on-shell condition eliminates these contributions, and indeed, in the A theorem and the LPR argument, they use the on-shell condition, so they don't care about these effects. The generalized E4 anomaly has this form. For those of you who are familiar with this, with the works related to the, and I know that there are people here familiar with it, the form of the effect, the generalized E4, the effective action, which is related to the E4 anomaly, is just contains in it what is known as the Wes-Domino action, okay, for the dilaton at the fixed point. But there are corrections which depend on the beta function. The interesting result that we found is that these corrections begin at order b squared. Okay? So the corrections of the Wes-Domino action begin at b squared. I hopefully have time in one of the next slides to explain the importance. But this is not a trivial result because it's related to show that we had to use a consistency condition. Okay, so this is not a trivial result. So these were the ultra-local interactions in the Dirac effective action. Now, what about the non-local part, where the term which looked like dn of w, where the Dilton coupled to composite operators? So what we found is that this expression does indeed exponentiate, and it can be written in this form. Okay, there is an operator, exponentiated operator, where you have k Diltons coupled to a composite operator, because this thing acts on W. And the coefficient is, and we denoted by VKI. Okay? So VKI is a coefficient of a coupling of K diletons to OI. Okay? So for example, for the case of the dimension 4 operators, it's given by this. Okay, so graphically, it would look something like this. One dilaton is coupled by the coefficient B, two diletons coupled by B, DJB, etc. And this indeed agrees with a more naive procedure of simply absorbing the dilaton into the renormalization scale. Okay? Notice that if this was my operator, if I absorb the dilaton into the renormalization scale and expand it in tau, I will get something which looks like this. So our computation agrees with this standard result. But it allows you to generalize it and to consider also the dimension 3 operators and dimension 2 operators. Okay? But regarding the dimension 3 vectors, we already know that by choosing this gauge SA equals 0, they do not contribute, as long as you're using B instead of beta. The coupling to dimension 2 operators is more complicated, because now you can have couplings of the dilaton with box of the dilaton, etc. So the computation was not the analytic expression is not something I can write on the blackboard, but I can write the coupling of two diletons, phi diletons, to the theory. Why do I focus on this guy? Because notice the following form. That again, I'm here looking at how does two phi diletons, up to two phi diletons, couple to the composite operators. And I get these types of terms. And notice here you have box of phi. Okay? So again, if I use the on-shell condition, I eliminate these two lines. And if I had something which is related to an improvement, if this TA is non-zero, I would not know about it, okay? Because I imposed the on-shell condition. So the on-shell condition cleans my amplitude from this effect, which could have been of order one. Okay? So this is a useful result for this discussion. So this is a summary of what we did. We have a systematic approach for this Dirac effective action, and we have been able to clarify the importance of the on-shell condition, also of criticality. So for example, just two slides of how to use these results to prove that this chi ij is indeed positive definite. Okay, remember we have this discussion, this very important equation. But somewhere we said that if this is positive definite, we have irreversibility. But how do you prove that it is positive definite? So in fact, you can only do it in perturbation theory at the moment, in four dimension. And one way of doing it is the following. So consider the four-point function of phi with on-shell kinematics. Okay. So I'm just taking W and taking four derivative with respect to phi. This can be translated into this combination of correlators of T. Okay? Now, I will assume that we're close enough to the fixed point such that B is a good expansion parameter. So the leading contributions to this amplitude would be S squared times this. According to the computation that I showed you, I'm just summarizing them. We have A twiddle with correction of B squared, and we have this expression where GIJ is a positive definite matrix related to the correlators of OIJ and OAOB. Okay? So this is a positive definite metric. Okay, because we're this is a positive definite metric if we're working in a unitary theory. Last slide. So now this is the expression. And indeed it's a non-trivial expression, but the only further input that I need to impose is that this is an amplitude, it is independent of mu. Okay? I take A and take the derivative with respect to mu, I get the running of A to the, and from here I get another factor of mu, I get BIBJ, GIJ. Okay? So you see that this thing, if this is positive definite, then AI twiddle changes monotonously, and we have the irreversibility of the RD flow in perturbation theory, okay, up to correction of order beta. Okay? So this is a nice way of using this machinery in order to prove the irreversibility of the RD flow in perturbation theory. And again, all we did was just impose that mu independence of the amplitude. So, the main points of the talk were that the local Kalinske magic equation can be used to characterize RG flow either by using the consistency conditions or as a tool for computing correlators of T. And you saw that there is a lot of know-how involved in the process. We have improved the notation of the formalism in a way which isolates only the interesting constraints, and we found an analytic expression for the Dilaton effective action. And we proved that indeed the scattering amplitude involved in the A's theorem are insensitive to lower dimension operators. Okay? Now, there are many open questions. What happens when you take this equation and impose supersymmetry? Can you find interesting relation between dilatations and R symmetry? One of the things that we assumed that the global symmetries were not anomalous. We did not discuss the effect of chiral anomalies. So this is something that we're trying to work on now. Another important question is what can we learn from the constraints of the F squared anomaly? But for me, the most interesting question is, can we say something beyond just the question of irreversibility? Can we constrain, for example, accidental symmetries in the IR? If you have a theory in the UV and a theory in the IR, can you say something about, can you constrain how many symmetries you have in the IR? And this is a question that we would like to pursue in the future. So I will stop here. Thank you. Questions?
How feasible do you think it is to extend this techniques in terms of different spot values?
Okay, so in fact, in the paper of 91, in Osborne's paper, he already incorporated the boundaries into this formalism. I never got deep into these parts, but it's the beginning at least has been done.
So the first conclusion you have to talk is that it helps to characterize RG flows.
Yes.
So can you say qualitatively, what is the characteristic on RGE flows that you now establish?
So one of the results that, so the A theorem implies that if you start from and then there is a discussion of LPR, which says that as you asymptotically go to the limits of your RGE flows, you cannot end up in something which is scale and not conformal, at least in perturbation theory.
But those are mostly statements. Well, the second statement about what happened at the boundaries, but
yes,
help you to say that you're characterizing the RG flow, you're actually characterizing the flow.
Yes.
Is there anything you understand better about the flow itself?
Okay, so this is one of the main things that we're trying to see. Okay, so for example, you could use this stuff, these consistency conditions, to cleverly simplify computations of higher orders loop computations, because you have these relations between the non-trivial relation between the coefficients of the anomaly and the beta function. So you could use these tricks as a way of computing higher order loops at less expensive computations. This is something that I think Osborne is working on nowadays. But hopefully it will also, yeah, this is a, yeah.
What was this equation that you did not know how to interpret? Did you try to see what would be its holographic implication?
We didn't get to this part. Good question.
I mean, some of those theories that the guys from UC and Diego did, those are pretty simple theories, right? Just a bunch of scalars, fermions.
Yep.
How does that equation look like in both theories?
So in those, theories, they indeed they. So what you
did
find?
Did they encounter this equation in their? Did they encounter this equation in their theories?
So what they showed in the end is that they did use this equation. Okay. They were already discussing it in their paper. And they found that indeed the results are that their B is zero. Okay, so they computed beta function, but then they also computed S and found out that together they combine in a way such that B vanishes. Such, and in fact, they do have a CFT. What they found was a CFT. Okay.
Okay, so one more question. Thanks a lot.